It's Wednesday, April 17th, 2018, and here's your update. A Canadian teenager is facing prison for downloading unsecured files from a Nova Scotia government website. 10-year-old Windows freeware makes a comeback. Facebook explains what data it collects on other websites. Europe's data protection authorities have their sights on the Whois database. Why Microsoft built its own custom Linux kernel. Russia blocks over 16 million IP addresses. And finally, why New York City stopped building subways. This is Hacker Daily, a new daily podcast for hackers. A 19-year-old Canadian teenager is facing potential prison time for accessing 7,000 documents on a Nova Scotia provincial government website, according to the CBC. He accessed the documents by apparently enumerating integer IDs in the URLs. A blogger named Evan Dontremont adds, Nova Scotia's Freedom of Information web service had been unavailable for the better part of a week without much of an explanation. On April 12th, the Minister of Internal Affairs announced the web service had been compromised and a suspect was in custody. The CBC describes a police raid on the family's home in detail. The family was going through its morning routine last Wednesday when the police banged on the front door. The mother says she, her husband, and two of her kids were corralled in the living room. They read us our rights and told us not to talk, she said. Our daughter, she was really traumatized, really bad. It brought her to tears the way they conducted this, said the father. She says at one point there were 15 officers in the home. People were going into the kitchen, were going into the dining room, going upstairs. They went into the basement. They were traipsing through the house everywhere, the mother said. Hacker News commenter S. Barr writes, This reads like the beginning of the hacker crackdown. As a Canadian, reading this article made me angry. If their information is not supposed to be public, it should not be reachable without authorization or authentication. Never mind a curious 19-year-old, there are tons of crawlers and indexers out there that attempt to enumerate URLs where they think there might be other content. Shame on them for building a poorly secured site, but even more for trying to railroad a curious kid who made them look stupid.
A link to Nearsoft, a 10-year-old page of Windows freeware utilities, rose to the top of Hacker News. Nearsoft is a one-person dev shop run by Nir Sofer, hence Nearsoft, originally created in 2001. Over the course of 17 years, Nir has written over 100 small utilities for Windows, including once popular tools like IPNetInfo and Protected Storage Passview. The footprint of each of these utilities is extremely small, usually less than 100 kilobytes. At one point in 2008, the website saw 850,000 unique visitors and 13.5 million hits. The page struck a nostalgic chord with many HN users. Kevin Dong wrote in a comment, The early 2000s were a different time. Modern-day Electron apps are regularly 100-plus megabytes. Reificator added, I've seen and used Nearsoft products for years. Never realized his name was Nir Sofer. What a great name for a software developer. Myself248 wrote, I can't claim to have used all of Nearsoft's tools, or even half of them, but I've used more than a handful and they always do exactly what they claim. Quickly, quietly, and compactly. This guy is a personal hero of mine, and I'm proud to say I sent him a few bucks a few years ago to say thanks. I don't know how many others think to do so, but I hope it's a lot of us.
David Baser, a product management director at Facebook, released a detailed post explaining what data Facebook collects on websites using Facebook social tools. He writes, Many websites and apps use Facebook services to make their content and ads more engaging and relevant. These services include social plugins, such as like and share buttons, Facebook Login, which lets you use your Facebook account to log into another website or app, Facebook Analytics, which helps websites and apps better understand how people use their services, and Facebook Ads and Measurement Tools. When you visit a site or app that uses Facebook services, Facebook receives information even if you're logged out or don't have a Facebook account. This is because other apps and sites don't know who is using Facebook. Comments on Hacker News were almost universally negative. DJ Rogers had a skeptical take, a top comment on the thread, saying, If one takes out all the defensive posturing, like the entire paragraph explaining that Twitter, LinkedIn, Amazon, and Google all do the same thing, we are left with this. Facebook tracks virtually every website you visit, as well as usage data for many apps, even if you aren't logged into Facebook or don't have an account. Facebook uses this data and ties it to your identity whenever possible so that they can charge advertisers more money. Commenter Marcel had a different take. Contrary to most comments here, it is significant that other companies do this. Facebook competes in the free market. If they scale back on data collection, that will hurt their offering to advertisers and cost them money that will go to Google and others. That lost revenue will harm their ability to retain talent and build new products, and ultimately cost them their user base. "We don't track you" is not as compelling a feature as free video chat across the globe. Facebook doesn't operate in a vacuum. They can't scale back data collection unless others do. Moreover, the United States doesn't exist in a vacuum either. Scaling back all U.S. companies will give a leg up to competitors in more lenient jurisdictions. The Register reports that Europe's data protection authorities sent a letter this week to ICANN, the nonprofit organization that oversees the use of internet domains, noting that the Whois database that lists the contact information for owners of domain names does not comply with GDPR, the new EU privacy regulations. Author Kieran McCarthy writes that the letter also has harsh words for ICANN's proposed interim solution, criticizing its vagueness and noting it needs to include explicit wording about what can be done with registered data, as well as introduce auditing and compliance functions to make sure the data isn't being abused. The president of ICANN's Global Domains Division, Akram Atella, told the Register that there was general agreement that having everything public is not the right way to go, and that he was hopeful that the letter would not result in the Whois service being turned off completely while a replacement was developed. Commenter C. Katzner writes, "Note that since the issue is GDPR compliance, this should only be a problem for registrants who are natural persons. So if Whois data were only collected and published for corporations, there shouldn't be a problem. I always felt uncomfortable having to submit my personal data, specifically my address and phone number, and for it to be published like that. I can understand the motivation for this with regards to corporations and organizations, but what benefit is there with regards to natural persons?" Titol adds, "A little known fact, Whois is extensively relied upon by spam fighters like Spamhaus to do their good work, which collectively saves all of us from an enormous tidal wave of spam that would otherwise consume vast resources. Internally, the anti-spam and more generally the anti-abuse community builds a huge and mostly real-time cross-reference database of information about domains and IP addresses. This database would be impossible to build without Whois. For example, if one domain shares the same contact email address as another, then the domains are related somehow. Doing some data mining on a variety of signals which are apparent in the Whois records can help to cluster related domains to help anti-abuse researchers find newly problematic domains by following the trail through Whois. I'm not sure how researchers will do their job effectively without Whois. This development is truly a disaster for anti-abuse."
TechCrunch covered Microsoft's announcement of Azure Sphere, a secure end-to-end IoT product that focuses on microcontroller-based devices. Azure Sphere is not a Windows product, but a custom Linux kernel shared under an open-source software license. Azure Sphere chips will feature built-in connectivity. This will allow them to connect to the Azure Sphere security service in the cloud in order to download security updates. AWS launched a similar device last year. Both Amazon and Microsoft are hoping to capture mindshare in the booming cloud services market with their offerings. HN user Tying Q comments about the device, "It's pretty surreal for those of us that worked through the anti-Linux Microsoft of the 90s. Windows Subsystem for Linux and initiatives like this are a real confirmation that Microsoft finally gets it. Right tool for the right job. Good for them. It's also a big swing for me in that I trust Microsoft more than Google now to do the right thing. I'd have thought that impossible a couple of decades ago." HN commenter Jesser Young writes about the press coverage, "Am I missing something here? The custom Linux kernel part isn't interesting at all. In fact, Microsoft has pretty much admitted that they can't scale down Windows. What's interesting to me here is Microsoft is building an IoT solution that allows manufacturers to delegate security to Microsoft instead of having to roll their own."
Bleeping Computer is reporting that Russia's telecommunications watchdog banned over 16 million IP addresses belonging to Amazon and Google's cloud infrastructure. That number is up from 1.8 million when the story was first posted earlier on Tuesday. The article says, the move to ban these IP blocks is a response to Telegram moving some of its infrastructure to AWS and Google Cloud servers over the weekend. The Russian telecommunications watchdog banned the Telegram instant messaging client inside Russia's border on Friday, April 13th, after Telegram refused to hand over customers' encryption keys to the FSB, Russia's main intelligence service. By moving service to Amazon and Google Cloud, Telegram was able to skirt the initial ban and provide service to Russian users over the weekend. The ban also affected many legitimate services hosted on AWS and Google Cloud, from multiplayer games to mobile apps and cryptocurrency trading services. Hacker News commenter Peter Cooper points out that the founder of Telegram posted a message in his public Telegram channel about the ban, saying, "For the last 24 hours, Telegram has been under a ban by internet providers in Russia. The reason was our refusal to provide encryption keys to Russian security agencies. For us, this was an easy decision. We promised our users 100% privacy and would rather cease to exist than violate this promise. Despite the ban, we haven't seen a significant drop in user engagement so far, since Russians tend to bypass the ban with VPNs and proxies. We also have been relying on third-party cloud services to remain partly available for the rest of our users." Another commenter asks, "Why block Telegram and not all the others? WhatsApp, Signal, Viber? Are they objecting to the use of encryption?" Foka86 replies, "Telegram is not the most popular messenger in Russia, but it is widely used by people who tend to be opposed to the current government, like young professionals. Also, there are a lot of anonymous Telegram channels curated by the opposition."
CityLab reports on the history of New York City subway construction in a piece titled, "Why New York City Stopped Building Subways." They write, "Since December 16, 1940, New York has not opened another new subway line, aside from a handful of small extensions and connections. Unlike most other great cities, New York's rapid transit system remains frozen in time. Commuters on their iPhones are standing in stations scarcely changed from nearly 80 years ago." CityLab pinpoints the cause of the construction standstill to three factors: the rise of suburbia and the accompanying shift in usage to cars for transport, increasingly contentious battles for control of the subway, first between the city government and a myriad of private transit companies, and now between the city government and state government, and the compounding effects of deferring maintenance while costs continue to rise. This has led to a backlog of maintenance to-dos, which now well exceed available budgets for new construction. HN user T.E. Muse writes, "NYC should stop building subways with tunnel boring. Instead, tear up the street, build the darn thing, and then rebuild the street over it. This method is called cut and cover, and it's what many countries do because it's substantially cheaper and faster." Jory responds, "You may be overestimating how easy cut and cover is. I live in the city of Antwerp, where they decided to dig up the central crossing that connects the main shopping street with the main traffic hub, in order to redesign it so cars would go underneath and shoppers can walk across the crossing unimpeded. It was planned for 18 months and now is projected to be closer to 3 years. That's all for Hacker Daily today, Wednesday, April 16th. We want to make Hacker Daily better every day, and we can't do it without your feedback. You can reach us via email at info@hackerdaily.co or follow us on Twitter @HackerDailyCo. And we'll be back tomorrow with more updates. Thanks for listening and have a great day.